You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hey, Kelly, how you doing?
Great. Great to see you.
Great. Great to see you, too. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, so thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. But why don't I introduce us? So I am Connor Eccles. I'm the host of Non-Zero World and the managing editor of the Non-Zero newsletter. You are Kelly Vlahos, the editorial director of Responsible Statecraft, which is the online magazine of the Quincy Institute. You're also, let me make sure I get all these. So you're the contributing editor at the American Conservative. You're the host of the podcast Trip the Beltway Fantastic. Am I missing anything?
No, that's great. I sound very busy.
Sound very busy, and I'm sure you are very busy. So I appreciate you taking time to chat with us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for context too, for listeners and full disclosure, Kelly was my editor, and I am a former reporter at Responsible Statecraft. So it's fun for us to be meeting back up like this. But the real advantage of having you on here today, Kelly, is that you are really deeply involved in these debates around conservative foreign policy, and we're in a really fascinating time in Republican foreign policy in general. So I want to talk, obviously, about this crazy signal chat story, about the bombings in Yemen and all those different things. But first, I wondered if you could just sort of lay out for our listeners how you see the like rough taxonomy of the different kind of tribes within Republican foreign policy today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm very heartened on one level, because having worked at the American Conservative since 2007 in terms of like contributing as a contributing editor at first, and then I literally worked as managing and then executive editor there, I had seen this evolution of paleo conservatives, populists and libertarians who were very critical of the U.S. war policies of that time in the 2000s, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars actually pull together and have some political influence, to the point where we are now seeing some of the people who I know have been fellow travelers who have either worked with, wrote for, or supported the American Conservative and those principles actually in the administration today and among the MAGA, among the people who elected Donald Trump. They believe in the spirit of radically changing our U.S. foreign policy away from militarism and towards more diplomacy. So we've made big strides, or at least the conservative movement has made big strides in terms of really having an impact on the conversation, which is making a lot of the retreads in the administration, in the Republican Party, in conservative, or the right side of the dial, those folks who hail from the neoconservative or the Cold War warrior days, who really have chafed against this new movement. They're very threatened right now. And you see that in some of the smear jobs against some of the folks that Donald Trump has tried to bring into the administration. So you see this battle going on between the old and the new in real time happening. And, you know, I would say those are the two main branches. It's basically right. The war party types who consist of the neocons and the Cold War warrior retreads. And then the spirit of non-interventionism, realism, restraint. You know, and there are different shades on that side too.
Yeah.
But I do think you're seeing the struggle, and I'm happy to see it happen. I'm unhappy to see that some of the smear tactics that had been used back in the days of the global war on terror, in which folks were called unpatriotic if they didn't support a war policy. And in those days, it was going to Iraq and invading and deposing Saddam Hussein. Now it seems like those smears are being used against folks like Danny Davis, for example, because he doesn't support wanting to go to war with Iran, or doesn't fully support the U.S. Fueling Israel's war in Gaza. So you see that the same tactics have been taken out of the closet and brushed off. And that makes me a little sad, because I feel like, you know, it takes a lot of energy to try to remain focused on the goals, but then have to respond
right
to a lot of these faceless, baseless attacks. But it is what it is.
Yeah. So I guess, so the rough split then is between, maybe like a GOP old guard, you know, peace through strength almost is maybe how they would argue it. And then the sort of America first, kind of new guard, they've got all these new ideas, and we're really seeing, I mean, it is kind of remarkable in just a few years how much the center of gravity has shifted on the Republican yeah. side, like you were saying, right? There simply were no people at these high levels, and now we're seeing more. And I want to talk more about, you mentioned Danny Davis. I want to talk more about that. But maybe let's, you know, just to give people, before we dive into the signal thing, it might be helpful to identify sort of people who fit into these camps. So I guess, would you agree that, you know, on the old guard camp, you've got, I guess, Michael Waltz, who's the national security advisor, sort of more that brand. I guess Marco Rubio, though that's a little debatable. He's the Secretary of yeah. State. He's kind of slowly shifted a little bit. But so some of those guys, and then on the restraint side, I guess the most prominent one would be Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence. And I don't know,
J.D. Vance.
And J.D. Vance, right, of course. Yeah, J.D. Vance.
And,
Yeah, are there other, like, characters we should identify before we dive in? It's just, I'm trying to kind of help people have a sense before we dive in.
Oh, sure. Elbridge Colby,
right.
Who is up for Deputy Secretary of Defense, has not been confirmed yet. He is a realist. Is he a restrainer? I don't know about that. but I put him in the camp of fellow traveler, because right. when he goes out there, he says, listen, I don't want to get in a war with China, but I think that we need to, you know, we have to deter China. And so the differences maybe between the restrainers and the realists for whom Elbridge Colby represents is that he wants to build up the military in the region to deter China from going to war over Taiwan. Does not believe that a war with Taiwan would be good for anybody, their side or our side. So, and then the difference is restrainers also agree that deterrence is important, but how much
right.
do we show before we tip the scales in escalating some conflict? You know, to me, if that's the debate and he's willing to have it, I'm all for that. He literally does not want to go after China for ideological reasons. He's a realist. And so is John Mearsheimer. And John Mearsheimer sees China as more of a hegemonic threat than, say, some of the realists. But he still doesn't want to go to war. And he still is framing his arguments in what is in the best interest of the United States. He's not framing his arguments that we have to go after China because we have to impose our values on that part of the world. We have to make sure that, you know, that there is no bigger hegemon in the world than us. So, you know, like I said, there are different shades.
Right.
Elbridge Colby is up for this nomination. And guess what? The neocons have smeared him as well. And they've gone after him because he's made such realist comments out, maybe a war with Iran wouldn't be in the best interest of the United States. I mean, for that, he's been scorned and vilified by members of the neoconservative flank. So that's what we're up against. And there are a number of other folks who are lower down, but in very important spots in the Department of Defense and Department of State that maybe 10 years ago would not have been included. You have Mike Domino, Dan Caldwell, both guys from Defense Priorities. You have Michael Anton, who is squarely on the right, but has also vocalized an interest in seeing that the U.S. Not go to war with China over Taiwan, has vocalized more restrained views on foreign policy. And so I do think that there's some glimmers of hope there.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Dan Caldwell. Maybe that's our transition over to the Signal thing, because he's actually mentioned by name in the Signal chat that, of course, ended up being leaked isn't quite the right word when you just include a journalist in your group chat. But to remind people of what's happened, if somehow you missed what seems to be the biggest story of the Trump administration so far. But Michael Waltz, the national security advisor, created a group chat on the sort of secure messaging app Signal, secure by civilian standards, not necessarily by government standards, that had all of the major actors in the Trump administration having a debate over how and whether to strike the Houthis, who have, of course, been endangering shipping in the Red Sea. This is largely shipping between kind of Europe and Asia, but who have been lobbing missiles, they say, in order to help secure a ceasefire in Gaza. So this has been going on now for a year and a half, this sort of process that we're seeing. And we can talk about whether we think that there's any chance of success from these. But first, what did you see in that Signal chat? What did that tell you about how these different factions within the conservative movement are sort of playing out in the administration?
It was really fascinating, Connor, and a mixed bag as well. So at one point, J.D. Vance says, I'm not sure this is the right time to do something like this. I'm not sure this is foreign policy. I'm not sure that we need to be focused on this when we are clearly trying to get a peace agreement and Ukraine, lots of energy going in that direction. We have issues with the economy back home. You know, let's set some priorities. I mean, I don't think he used the word priorities, but the general spirit of his pushback in that chat was, let's take a deep breath. Let's focus on Ukraine. And this might not be within the scope of Trump's foreign policy right now. And the only person that I recall that enjoined Vance's comments was Joe Kent, who is a former special forces, I believe, lost his wife in war because she was also military, and very conservative, very MAGA, but also had made part of his own campaign and political approach being a more restrained foreign policy, because he felt that the United States had stretched its forces too thin, that it was engaging in regime war change wars that could not be effectively explained to the American people. He was the only one who pushed or joined Vance in saying, well, maybe we could put this off. I mean, are the conditions going to be any different a month from now than they are now? And Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defense, immediately charges in saying no, and I don't have the chat in front of me, but saying something to the effect of, you know, we might lose a window, that we will look weak if we don't strike now. I mean, it was coming out of the mouths of any American hawk in Washington over the course of 40 years, showing weakness, has to seize the moment. You know, there seemed to be this spirit of like, we must be out there ensuring freedom of navigation, all the talking points displayed. So
I think he said that we're the only country that like can do this. It's unfortunate, but we're the only country that can restore this. So we must.
Yeah, and that this is playbook territory. And so Vance did push back gently. And he did mention the fact that these are European trade routes, and that the Europeans should be like kind of maybe investing a little bit more in the security of the Red Sea. And he didn't want to bail the Europeans out again. And so there was a little discourse about American interests there. Obviously, overruled by the rest of the group. Once the bombs started falling, you know, Vance said something, you know, to I pray for our troops and, you know, we have victory now when the bomb hit a residential building. So that wasn't too cool, you know, in my mind. Yeah. But at that point, what was he actually going to do? It seems to me that this had already been set into motion from a much higher level. And it was going to be what it was going to be. I'm, you know, happy to see there was a ton of like, not a ton, but a little bit of red teaming on this chat. But, you know, obviously the Hawks won the day.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of my question is the what we see in the chat and also just the fact of these strikes happening, of us returning to what was the Biden administration's approach to this. Is this a signal that the Hawks are kind of getting the upper hand in these internal battles within the administration?
I think it remains to be seen, Connor, because I feel like this is a matter of issue by issue. So the Hawks are clearly not getting their way on the Ukraine issue, for example. Mm. They are getting their way on this particular piece of the portfolio, the Yemen piece. They honestly, you know, they believe or at least they're vocalizing that we have to show force to the Houthis as well as Iran, which they are still convinced that Iran control the Houthis. So this is a way to send a message to both Iran and the Houthis to back off, that we are fully in support of Israel in its war in Gaza, and it's not going to brook any of these further attacks on shipping. And this, you know, we've seen this before. The Biden administration did the same thing. They said, we have to show a strong message to the Houthis that it is unacceptable to interfere with global shipping routes. And what happened? The Houthis are still there. They're still attacking ships. They haven't gone away. So obviously, this is not a problem that is easily solved with military might. What is a surprise, or I guess maybe it's not so much of a surprise, but you know, you wonder, did these guys ever get that maybe the solution is political, that perhaps we should be talking about maintaining a ceasefire that the United States helped broker in Gaza, and the Houthis stopped attacking during that ceasefire because for them, the only reason they are attacking is because of Israel's war in Gaza. Maybe that's where we should be directing our energy, is to the ceasefire and not expending $2 million missiles every hour trying to thwart these Houthi attacks. Well over $2 billion worth of missiles have been launched at the Houthis in the last 17 months, and to no avail, apparently.
Yeah, it's just so interesting. It seems as if, I mean, there's just this, it's, I don't know if it's ironic or what it is exactly, but it's fascinating that really the core of the movement for an America first foreign policy on the right started in the Middle East, right? It was the idea that we had gotten bogged down in these conflicts. Yep. It was that we had essentially overstretched ourselves and done all these unnecessary things that weren't serving Americans home. But it seems that the hardest place to actually apply those lessons from the point of view of this administration, and I guess any administration recently, is in the Middle East itself. It's this really weird kind of combination of things.
Yeah, you hit the nail. And what I'm seeing now is a split between those conservatives and MAGA who have been entirely consistent on this Middle East issue and in their critique of U.S. foreign policy and their wish to see us pull back, and those who will just go along with whatever the prevailing view of the administration is at that given moment. And so, and in particular on Israel. And I've seen this split. And again, I'm not completely pessimistic about it, because I think maybe 10 years ago, everybody on the right would have been pro-Israel, unconditional, pro, like, give them whatever it takes of my tax dollar money, pro, bomb the hell out of any country that gets in our way. And by the way, go to war with Iran while you're at it. And now what I'm seeing on social media is an absolute split. I see a lot of folks going, this is not America first. I can't tell you how many times I've seen that. And that started really with when Trump announced his plan for Gaza to empty Gaza, move Palestinians away, and then control Gaza and completely reconstruct it and not be clear about whether anybody could come back. And I saw on social media from right-wing accounts, people saying, this is not what I voted for. This is not America first. What's going on with the border? What's going on with all these things you said you were going to do for us here in this country? Yeah. And that's continued all the way through to today on the issue of the airstrikes. I interviewed Thomas Massie yesterday, and he is always consistent on these principles. And by the end of the interview,
Thomas Massie being a representative from what state's he from again?
Kentucky.
Kentucky, a Republican representative from Kentucky, very kind of libertarian, America first, very strong. Yeah.
Very strong. But at the end of the interview, we're mostly talking about the lack of authorization for the strikes in Yemen. But I did ask him about, you know, Gaza and the Houthis and whether we need a political solution. He said, listen, all of our meddling in the Middle East is doing us no good. All of our fueling of this war in Gaza is blowing back at us. And it's not even good for Israel. This isn't America first. And I was like, thank you, because I feel like he's vocalizing what a lot of people are feeling right now. And folks on the right, I think, are struggling because on one hand, they're being told they have to support Israel at any cost. And if they don't, it's anti-Semitic. But then there's this other struggle that they're going through where they go, well, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't feel like America first. This isn't what I voted for. I don't want our troops to be in the Middle East. I don't want them to be in harm's way anymore. And so I feel like the more official word about this, people like Tom Massie and others that come out and are brave enough to say it, that emboldens others on the right to say, wait a minute, I really like Trump. I voted for him, but I think he might be going in a wrong direction here.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder. So, you know, that's an interesting conversation you had with him. And like I said, he's very, like, you know, very libertarian, very sort of distinct on these issues in some ways. I'm curious because it feels like there is movement towards a potential, you know, kind of early movement, but towards a potential war with Iran, right? It's obviously there'd be lots of dynamics playing out within the administration. Those are sort of hard to suss out until we could get more reporting in that direction. I imagine that people like Vance would not be super anxious to do that kind of thing. But I'm curious what role you see for Congress in all that. Do you think that the Republicans in Congress would be able to make any moves on that? Or do you think that they would tend to just sort of go along with that like other Trump moves?
You know, and if we work together, Connor, I think we probably covered a number of these stories about members, even of the Republican Party, trying to issue war powers resolutions in an attempt to either prevent a war from happening or to say that a current intervention was not authorized. And whether it be in Yemen, I know that Congressman Matt Gaetz was trying to get our troops home from Somalia and Syria. And it's so difficult. I think the war party has such a grip on Congress that at any given time, you have the party considerations. So if Biden is president, then you have to convince all Democrats to get on board with a resolution that's going to challenge the executive's decision to go to war with XYZ or to bring home troops from XYZ. And then hope that you And then you can enjoy the Republicans who really just don't like the guy in the White House and are ready to just like go against anything he's doing, and then try to muster up enough votes for that. And then even if you do pass, the way the War Powers Act is set up, that the president can veto that resolution, and then you have to come up with 2/3 to override right. that veto. So the hill is so high to climb. And so when you have something like this, where we are so pulled apart on domestic issues right now for all obvious reasons, it's going to be really difficult to get, you know, enough to amass enough energy to push back on, say, a future war with Iran or even these airstrikes. I asked Massey, and he couldn't tell me that there was any movement to issue a war powers vote. I mean, it's all in such a nascent stage now, which to me, that doesn't bode well, because they're already like 14 days into these airstrikes. And Trump is saying that they're going to go on for a very long time. And there's nobody in Congress saying, okay, I'm going to introduce a bill now. Let's get this going. We're not even at that stage yet. And as far as Iran goes, my goodness. I mean, talk about another third rail. Besides Israel, this is the next third rail. Nobody wants to come out and look like they're defending Iran on either side of the aisle. And so it's going to be difficult. It's going to have to take principled folks like Massey, Rand Paul, Ro Khanna, maybe some others, Rashida Tlaib and others, to really like really step over that rail and say, listen, we can't go to war with Iran. But there are so many people in Washington, so many interests that want to go to war, that you got to be ready for a fight on that score. And it's already happening.
Yeah, it does seem like. Yeah, the groundwork is the interesting part, because it does seem like you're getting all of these arguments that, you know, yes, we can do a deal with Iran, but Iran has to eliminate even its civilian nuclear program, and it has to pull back completely from the region. And those kind of come off as poison pills, right? It kind of comes off as like, you know, we can make it seem as if we were doing negotiations, and that opens the door for more conflict. It's a worrisome thing.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a story on responsible statecraft. I believe it came out yesterday by Sina Tusi, who acknowledged that, you know, the headline is the war over the war with Iran, that there is a active campaign by your usual suspects, the neoconservatives and war hawks in Washington, that are helping to lay the groundwork. Obviously, a lot of this groundwork is already there, you know, for the last 20 years, through the last two administrations or three administrations. And what they are doing is systematically smearing and trying to take out any voices, particularly within the Trump world, who are reticent for going to war. And they're calling those people isolationists. You know, they're calling those people anti-Israel, probably anti-Semitic as well. Or they're making it out to be a personal character flaw if you do not support a muscular foreign policy in the Middle East. There's something wrong with you. My hope is that there are enough voices of sanity within the Trump administration, within his inner circle. And that includes his own son, Don Jr., who has turned out to be one of those realist and restrainer voices.
Yes.
I should have mentioned him earlier, because he doesn't have an official role, but you know, he just came out swinging on behalf of J.D. Vance, because they tried to go after him, the Jewish Insider magazine, which has been engaging in this campaign against Trump nominees, tried to go after J.D. Vance for the same thing, that he was detracting from Trump's foreign policy for questioning the Yemen strikes and not being forceful enough on going to war with Iran. And he came out and he's like, what are you talking about? This is one of the most principled people. And like, I am not going to listen to the same neocons who got us into the war with Iraq. And I'm like, go Don Jr.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's what it comes down to. Like you said, Connor, a lot of the critique is born out of this absolute distrust of an establishment in Washington that convinced us that we needed to go into war with Iraq, depose Saddam Hussein, lied about the WMDs, put tens of thousands, millions of our men and women at risk over the course of almost 20 years between both countries, Iraq and Afghanistan. And now we're going to listen to them lead us down the primrose path into another war? I don't think so. So I'm glad that there are folks who are out there saying it. But we need to be very cognizant that this debate is going on, and it could, and that coupled with the pressure we're getting from Israel and the close relationship that this administration has with Israel, it could happen. It could happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned, so, you know, the Wall Street Journal has also been doing a lot of this sort of attempting to, their view on the signal thing has been similar to what you were saying with Jewish Insider, where they're making the argument that this is Vance, you know, undercutting the president or doing these different things. It's just been interesting to see the way that all of that has played out. But maybe this is a good time for us to go back and talk a little bit about the Danny Davis affair. So why don't I lay out a little bit of my understanding of it? You can correct me and then give me your take on it. But so basically, yeah, Danny Davis, he is a longstanding kind of commentator on the restraint side of things. I believe that he was a lieutenant colonel was his position in the military, yes. Right? Yeah, and he left the military in 2009 or so over, and it, like he kind of retired over disagreements about the policy in Afghanistan. Is that right?
Well, I'm not sure he retired because of it. I think that he had served in the first Persian Gulf War.
Right.
So he was close to his retirement anyway.
Okay.
So what he had done, if you don't mind me just telling the story a little bit,
go ahead,
is that
ahead.
In 2009, he had been in Afghanistan he was in an inspection team role where he was traveling throughout the country to the different outposts and the forward operating bases that we had in that war. And he came back and he's like, oh my goodness, nothing that I was told here in the United States from our top brass about what was going on that war and in the war was revealed to me when I was actually on the ground. There are two different stories here. The generals, including, you know, Petraeus, McChrystal, have been lying to us. They go to Congress and they say, you know, victory is right around the corner. We just need more troops. We need more money. We need more training of Afghan national police and army. You know, just hang in there. Everything that they needed to say so that the war could continue. He goes to Afghanistan and he sees victory is not on around the corner. We aren't winning. In many cases, our guys are just out there just trying to avoid getting killed. And the Afghan army is not, it may be equipped, but it's not capable of taking this country over anytime soon. And he wrote up a report, a classified report, and he gave it to Congress. And then he went and he wrote a piece for Armed Forces Journal, without the classified stuff, but just in the spirit of we're being lied to. And it was pretty explosive because at that time, there was a big push for counterinsurgency. There was a big push on the Obama administration to put more troops into Afghanistan. And he got its way. And that war was extended because of this idea that we could surge more troops in, and that's all we needed to do to clear, hold, and build and bring a government in a box to fix everything. I mean, they were heady times for the military industrial complex, and for somebody to come in and just kind of throw a stink bomb, it was really important because Danny was not some anti-war pacifist hater. He was just really angry and upset about what he saw as a veil that was being put on this, and the American public wasn't being told the truth.
Right.
And so he retired, but, you know, he paid for it. You know, he couldn't, I mean, nobody was going to have him work for them, whether it be at defense-related think tanks, consultants, working for the defense industry. And so, like, he, you know, he's just spent the last 15 years just being, a truth teller, has a great podcast, has done a lot of writing. He's at Defense Priorities now. He gets an offer to work with Tulsi in the Director of National Intelligence. And it's all on the down low. I mean, he had told me about it, but I wasn't, you know, he said, until it's official, I'm not going to say anything.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, there's a hit job in the Jewish Insider, and basically saying, oh, Danny has said all these awful things about Israel on his podcast. He doesn't want to go to war with Iran. And it just unearthed all these things that Danny has said that proves that he's not, quote unquote, fit for the job because he doesn't want to go to war with Iran. And he has criticized the U.S. fueling the war in Gaza that has been responsible for the killing of over 50,000 people. And he has put it in moral terms and military terms. Yeah. Danny is a Christian conservative. He has a moral core, and he believes that it is a moral imperative that we stop funding the war in Gaza. And he's vocalized that, and they pulled all that together. And next thing you know, Mark Levin, you know, crazy red meat, right wing radio jock, is tweeting about it, saying what a nightmare that Danny is. Laura, what's her name? Laura
Loomer, I think.
God, I forget her name. Yes, Loomer. She comes out and she retweets Mark Levin and said, you know, Danny would, it'd be a nightmare. He would be dangerous if he was in the new administration. And we're talking, like, collectively between those two nuts about, like, probably about 5 million followers. And so this spread like wildfire. And by that afternoon, I was going to write about it, and I was going to write a positive story about Danny and then maybe mention the smears at the end. I didn't want to give the smears too much oxygen. And I called Danny to see what was going on and if that would be okay with him. And he said, I was just told that there is no job anymore. Wow. Like, it just, and Tulsi had fought for him pretty hard. So I don't want to criticize Tulsi on this, but I think the pressure was too hot.
Yeah, I guess.
Unfortunate.
I guess a question that I have about that is like, why was the pressure different from your point of view in this case? Because we've had, you know, earlier in the Trump administration, there was a lot of criticism. You mentioned Michael Domino earlier. Mm-hmm. He is affiliated kind of with the restraint world. He's a former CIA guy. He's now the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, I think is the title. So he got a major thing. And some of these same outlets wrote very negatively about his nomination to this role. It's kind of a similar level to this, like, deputy DNI role that it's a little lower probably, but, you know, it's a serious role in the Pentagon. I guess, like, why did it work this time around when it didn't seem to work the first time?
I think because.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.